shipping, exporting to the industrialized world, and paying farm workers a decent wage, and curbing the subsidies and protections given to the huge landowners who throw peasants off their lands and force them to find less arable land. The above solutions are political, and there's serious question as to whether or not they're likely to be resolved without revolution. But like AIDS, overpopulation is a way of explaining away hunger and making it seem like an item which is outside the control of the governments in the Third World. Multinational corporations which grow stock, cut down trees, own huge agribusinesses in the Third World are committed to the present governments of those countries insofar as those governments offer them protection, huge tax breaks and subsidies. And feeding the population of the Third World is not an item on the agenda for these corporations. Now, I've heard just recently some information to the contrary that this may not be the case, but I have to see it to believe it. 35,000 to 40,000 people a day die from starvation in the world. At the same time, the biggest growth industry in the arena of agribusiness, as was explained to me, both in the U.S. and in Europe, is what? Storage facilities. That's right, storage for food. The biggest growth industry in the arena of agribusiness. Now, so there are those in America who recognize the contradiction inherent in all of this and feel guilty about it. Some of these have found it possible to enlist the cooperation in, say, Hands Across America type projects from the PR people of large corporations, many of which corporations are otherwise participating in perpetuating starvation in the Third World. There are also those in America who feel no need to resolve this contradiction between food glut and starvation around the world, and for those people, AIDS is a handy idea. It gives wing to a new myth, especially for Africa. They gave birth to the disease in Africa, and they're dying from it. We'll get to that in a minute. How many people know that AIDS has been redefined in the Third World so that the primary symptoms of starvation and malnutrition are now the primary symptoms of AIDS? You are among the few as of now. You'll find researchers, and this is important, they'll make these very nice distinctions concerning these three symptoms, chronic diarrhea, wasting away, and severe weakness. They'll tell you it depends which organisms are causing the diarrhea and how fast the wasting is occurring and so forth as to whether such these symptoms are really diagnosable as AIDS. But what you have to keep in mind is that in the Third World, part of the reason the AIDS is being defined so loosely in the first place is that medical care is scarce. Labs for good testing are even scarcer, you see. So they're looking for eyeball-type definitions and diagnoses. So you can be as subtle as you want with the various different causes of these symptoms, but under the tremendous pressure of a new disease, what doctors are going to do is go on the bandwagon and take the grossest aspects of these symptoms and, bingo, slap on a diagnosis, right? Because that's how things work in the boonies. Now, I suggest that you read The Lancet, October 24, 1987, and the references. I think there are three of them, for the clinical case definition of AIDS in Africa. Now, as far as the creation of AIDS, or the birth in Africa, okay? Having talked with some of the top orthodox AIDS researchers, the word these days is that Max Essex's theory of the African green monkey has been discredited. And if he's going to revive that theory, it's really going to take some doing. The virus in question is STLV3, which is the so-called African green monkey virus, which definitely has close homology to one of the supposed AIDS viruses. And, however, STLV3 has been found to come not from Africa, but from housed macaque monkeys at the New England Primate Research Center. Not from wild, but from housed macaques. So STLV3, whose origin is not necessarily Africa, but is unknown, has been a lab contaminant, understand? voiding the research on the viruses which Essex brought back from Africa to study. So Max goes to Africa. Max brings back viruses. STLV3, which is in macaque monkeys housed at the research facility, contaminates the lab. He finds the STLV3 and misidentifies it as the virus he brought back from Africa. That is the charge, okay? Now, how the housed macaques picked up the STLV is a mystery, because there are African greens there, too. Did they pick it up from African greens? But it's not such a simple question to answer, because, for starters, you'd have to know the experiments that have been carried out on these monkeys, because a lot of those experiments involve injecting them with various microbes and viruses, and you know, they're like living test tubes, living passage tissue. And we're not talking just about at Harvard or the New England Research Primate Center experiments, but around the world, because a lot of diseased tissue specimens from monkeys are shipped from lab to lab, country to country, as a matter of course, you understand? And that gives you an excellent chance of contamination. So there is no simple answer to the question of where did the macaques get the STLV3. But certainly, for the moment, the African theory has been ruled out as lacking in evidence by some of these researchers that I have spoken with. Interesting to note that during the special viral cancer project of the 70s, which was part of the war on cancer, many monkeys were treated with radiation and various chemicals, the purpose of which was to suppress their immune systems to such a degree that viruses which were injected in them that had so far not produced cancer would now produce cancer. So it's entirely possible that during the war on cancer, some primate virus, say an STLV3, was changed by passaging it through so many monkeys, subjecting it to all these various conditions, so that perhaps it became a virtual product of the lab instead of an endemic African or Asian microbe. You can ponder the possible consequences of that one. Now, we talked about, or I'm just mentioning here, this thing called the Special Viral Cancer Project, which was part of NCI, National Cancer Institute's War on Cancer in the 70s, declared by Richard Nixon, said to be a response to the fact that Teddy Kennedy was thinking of running for president in 72, and Teddy was favoring national health care, so they said, hey, Dick, you got to do something about health because your record stinks. And the result of that was, let's declare a war on cancer. Anyway, the Viral Cancer Project, of course, was an attempt to show a connection between viruses and cancer. There were other people at NCI in the 70s who were championing the idea that cancer was environmental and that there were many carcinogens and mutagens in the environment. And there was obviously conflict between these two groups. The people who were involved in the Viral Cancer Project were to become very well known in the world of virology and in research. Peter Duisberg, now molecular biologist at University of California at Berkeley. Robert Gallo, the co-discoverer of the so-called AIDS virus, HIV, Max Essex, of the green monkey theory. Montagnier, I believe, spent some time there. He is now the number one AIDS researcher in the, aside from Gallo, at the Pasteur Institute. David Baltimore, Nobel Prize winner. Folks like Kamen and Varmus, winner of the Lasker Award, I believe. They came out of this era, you see, and they came out of this era into the AIDS era. And what they... First of all, there were definitely people hanging around the Viral Cancer Project from the Army, military types who were interested in the biological warfare implications of this research. And there was a lot of data obviously being compiled and filed and cataloged by these people. Anyway, this was the environment, and in this environment, depending on one's point of view, a not very good result was obtained. The connection of viruses to cancer became questionable, and to this day there's a lot of argument about it. And in general, I've been told that you will find that when these people write papers on the connection of viruses to cancer these days, you will see much more qualification in their views. One of these people, Peter Duisberg, became disillusioned gradually over a period of time during the Viral Cancer Project, and he left the project. Others continued on. They were researching a new brand of virus, retroviruses. And when AIDS became an issue around 1980, there was a very comfortable, at least from the outside, segue where these people who had been researching these new kinds of retroviruses moved right into AIDS research. And AIDS research was aimed in the same direction. Let's look for retrovirus as the cause of AIDS was the, you know, the point. Duisberg did not agree with the point. And I will now read a short note on Duisberg. Eminent molecular biologist at the University of California at Berkeley has written articles in Cancer Research, March 1, 1987. That's the big one. And Biotechnology, November 1987, which is a summary of the cancer research article, rejecting outright the HIV virus as the cause of AIDS. Duisberg argues in Biotechnology that AIDS, quote, is latent and inactive not only in the 1 to 2 million Americans who test positive for antibody to the virus, but also in the 10,000 who annually develop AIDS and the 5,000 who die from it. Yet all other pathogenic viruses are known to be metabolically active when they cause disease, end quote. Even granting the idea that HIV somehow infects immune T cells, Duisberg argues, it would attack a tiny number compared to the numbers of T cells the body ordinarily replaces on its own. Duisberg also maintains that researchers have never satisfied postulates with the HIV virus. He also maintains that the idea of HIV as a slow-acting lentivirus is fiction supported by no facts. At NIH, he told me, they're looking for a gene in the HIV virus that would regulate the latency period and the sudden supposed breakout into virulence of the virus, but they haven't found anything. Finally, Duisberg states in Biotechnology, there is very little direct evidence for the presence of the HIV virus in people with AIDS, end quote. Duisberg says that the effort to find HIV in tissue of AIDS patients requires strenuous lab procedures in which incredibly tiny amounts of the virus at no concentration thought to be harmful, and this is me now, I'm not quoting Duisberg, are extracted and made to grow in the lab in dishes of cells. Then and only then can detectable concentrations be observed. In 50% of AIDS patients, he maintains, even this eking out of HIV cannot be achieved. Now, the main rebuttals to Duisberg's position are as follows. One, although most viruses of HIV's ilk are passive and harmless, there is at least one exception, Visna, a virus which causes slow incubating brain rot in sheep. And there is some homology between Visna and AIDS virus. Of Visna, Duisberg has said, quote, I haven't reviewed all the evidence yet. My feeling is that Visna doesn't really do what people say it does, but I can't make that statement completely definite, end quote. Second rebuttal. Some researchers believe they are on the verge of finding a genetic regulator in slow-acting viruses, which do cause them to suddenly break out and cause disease after dormant periods in their host. The most prominent researchers of these is Matthew Gonda, And his latest paper in Nature, I understand, is out now. And the rumor was it would offer some evidence in this direction. The third rebuttal, in other words, that there is some sort of a genetic, possible genetic regulator that would cause this slow-acting effect, which suddenly breaks out into virulent disease caused by the virus. The third rebuttal to Duisberg is, it is possible that HIV causes AIDS not by overwhelming human T cells, but by causing harmful processes in the human body simply because of its protein coating. Duisberg's reply to this tack is, quote, yes, there are theories about the coat setting off chain reactions in the body, but nobody has offered any proof that this happens. End quote. Now, Harvey Bialy, publisher of Biotechnology magazine, reports there are several important mainstream AIDS researchers, including at least one from the Pasteur Institute in Paris, who admit that any theory of HIV causation raises paradoxes. These researchers are interested in designing experiments that would establish, once and for all, HIV's role or non-role in AIDS. Apparently, however, none of these people are key researchers at the National Institutes of Health, where dominant U.S. AIDS research is funded. NIH people also duck debating Duisberg's specific criticisms of HIV as the cause of AIDS. This is what was making Jim Warner at the White House so mad. Duisberg finds himself in the odd position of listening to various exotic theories on how HIV is involved in AIDS. Many of these theories are unproven. He points this out. Yet those who offer the theories are on the side of defending HIV as the sole agent of the disease, as the proven agent, to which Duisberg says, if it's so well proven, why are people bringing such strange tales to me? Okay, now. Here's Duisberg's article. It's called The Last Word. It's the last page article in Biotechnology, November 1987. All right. He says, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, has become a cause célèbre for journals, companies, and scientists, and the, quote, deadly AIDS virus has been sold to the public as the cause of AIDS with the confidence and authority that is usually derived from absolute scientific proof. The bases of the virus AIDS hypothesis, in italics, are that this retrovirus was originally isolated from an immune-deficient patient, that 80 to 90% of AIDS patients have antibody to the virus, and that there is a reasonable correlation between antiviral antibodies and persons in high-risk groups for the disease. The hypothesis is appealing because it appears to fit a 100-year-old tradition of triumphs in medicine that proved viral and bacterial parasites to be the causes of contagious disease. But this appearance is deceptive. Three criteria need to be met before a virus can be said to function as a pathogen. It must be biochemically active. It must infect or intoxicate more cells than the host can regenerate or spare. And the host must be genetically and immunologically permissive. Yet almost none of the accumulated data on the, quote, human immunodeficiency virus, end quote, HIV, demonstrate that the virus satisfies any of these criteria. HIV is latent and inactive, not only in the 1 to 2 million Americans who have antibody to the virus, but also in the 10,000 who annually develop AIDS and the 5,000 who die from it. Yet all other pathogenic viruses are known to be metabolically active when they cause disease. Latency is the mechanism by which parasites typically survive as passengers in asymptomatic hosts, people without symptoms. HIV also fails to meet the second criterion, since it actively infects fewer than 0.01% of susceptible lymphocytes, and since 5% of T cells are regenerated during the 2 days it takes the virus to infect the cell. Moreover, it is truly paradoxical that HIV is said to cause AIDS only after an asymptomatic incubation period of at least 5 years, although antiviral immunity is induced within a few weeks. Ever since Jenner discovered the principle of vaccination, antiviral immunity, the basis of the AIDS test, has been considered the ultimate weapon against, rather than an indication for, future disease. In other words, he's saying antibodies to a virus indicate, you know, immunity, fighting the virus by the immune system, rather than, oh boy, you are prone to get this disease. Continuing with the article, consistent with the presence of antiviral antibody, there is very little direct evidence for the presence of the virus in persons with AIDS. There is not one report of a virus titer, meaning concentration, from an AIDS patient. Indeed, virus can only be isolated from 50% of symptomatic and asymptomatic carriers, and then only by techniques originally designed to activate latent viruses. The methods are to grow millions of cells in culture away from the immune system and as yet unknown suppressors of the host until at least one previously latent virus becomes active. This will then be multiplied by adding uninfected cells until a detectable titer is reached. Thus, isolating virus from 50% of AIDS patients implies that 50% carried less than one latent virus in several million cells. In other words, if you can only do this in 50% of AIDS patients, the other 50% carried less than one latent virus in several million cells. In fact, viral genomes have only been detected in about 15% of persons who test positive for HIV antibody. In these persons, about one proviral genome is found in 100 to 1,000 susceptible lymphocytes. In other words, 85% of antibody-positive persons carry either less provirus than this or none at all. Moreover, most of these proviruses are dormant since only 1 in 10,000 to 100,000 susceptible cells express viral RNA in both symptomatic and asymptomatic carriers. In contrast, the titers of other known retroviruses are between 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 12th infectious units per milliliter of serum or tissue when they function as pathogens. The virus AIDS hypothesis also totally fails to explain how the virus depletes T helper cells and why it takes at least 3 to 5 years to do so. Unlike all other animal viruses, retroviruses need mitosis to initiate infection. Moreover, no HIV gene remains inactive during replication, which takes about 1 to 2 days, as with all other retroviruses. Thus, HIV would be expected to kill T cells and cause AIDS when it first infects an organism, and not 5 years later, when it is biochemically inactive and suppressed by antiviral immunity. The 5-year latency presents proponents of the hypothesis with two bizarre options. Either old T cells die 5 years after infection, or the offspring must die in the 50th generation, given a 1-month generation time for the average T cell. Nevertheless, killing of T cells within weeks, not years, after infection has been observed in cell culture, in apparent agreement with the claim that the virus kills T cells. But this type of killing is fundamentally different from the unconditional cell lysis achieved by true cytocidal viruses. It involves cell fusion mediated via HIV antigens on the surface of infected cells and receptors at the surface of uninfected cells, and is conditioned on the cells and virus isolates used. Further, it does not occur in chronically infected human T cell lines that grow indefinitely in culture, yet produce more virus than any other system, nor has it ever been observed in blood taken from an AIDS patient. In fact, limited cell killing by fusion is a common feature of retroviruses, none of which have as yet been claimed to cause AIDS. It seems clear from the foregoing that the virus AIDS hypothesis fails to make a case for sufficiency. It offers no explanation for why less than 1% of antibody-positive persons develop AIDS, and why the mean latency between infection and disease is 5 years, whereas antiviral immunity is established in a few weeks. A latent period for pathogenicity that exceeds the latent period for immunity is unambiguous evidence for a cofactor or another causative agent altogether. Finally, the hypothesis cannot support a claim that the virus is even necessary for AIDS in view of the fact that it is barely present and consistently latent even in persons with the disease. Since the transmission of AIDS depends on frequent contacts involving the exchange of cells, the case for a viral cause remains open. Okay, so much needs to be debated with Peter Duisberg. Peter Duisberg is more than willing to debate. So far, none of the top AIDS researchers in America are willing to speak to his issues specifically and completely, aside from little squibs of stuff released through press officers and press people at NIH, CDC. Very important. Now, so let's look at some of the other possibilities that are involved here in this thing called AIDS, this syndrome called AIDS, okay? And I'm now referring to a book by Harris L. Coulter called AIDS and Syphilis, The Hidden Link. Coulter is C-O-U-L-T-E-R. The publisher is North Atlantic Books, Berkeley, California, and also Weehawken Book Company, Washington, D.C. All right. And these books are available in some bookstores. Very interesting book. Let's go to page 86 of the book. See what the book has to say. This is an interview that Coulter did with Joan McKenna, who has interviewed a number of AIDS patients in San Francisco from the beginning. And she says the following. This is very startling. We're now getting into the background of the AIDS patients, you see. We're talking now about a situation in which researchers found these men with pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, Kaposi sarcoma, fungal infections, oral candidiasis, these things which were certainly not unique in the history of medicine, but rare, relatively rare, and suddenly now they were starting to proliferate, okay? And they were largely proliferating in gay men. So, you know, what are you going to do? How do you follow up this research? What do you say? Where does this come from? What's happening? Why is this going on? Certainly the first factor would be, you know, has any intelligence at all, would say, let's look for common denominators, because we seem to be talking about a cultural group here, at least at the beginning, gay men. It's no different than if you and I and five other people are eating in a restaurant, right? And we all get sick. There's nothing about us that seems to indicate that a virus, you know, should just be infecting us and nobody else. So let's look and see what happened at the restaurant. What did they eat? So in this case, what did they eat are the backgrounds of the men. Now, it is true that epidemiological studies have been done, interviews have been done, surveys have been done. But I point out to you that apparently no systematic compilation of survey information on the case histories of the first, let's say, 100 AIDS patients has ever been put together. Or if it has, it has never been acknowledged with any force at the top of the research ladder. Robert Gallo says, it's the virus. That's all you need. Understand? That's what's happened to epidemiology. Joan McKenna, quote, I have histories of gay men who have been on tetracycline for 18 years for the possibility of a pimple. I guarantee you their body chemistry isn't normal. I have guys with almost unlimited prescriptions for erythromycin, because every two or three weeks they will get a sore throat and they'll take erythromycin for a few days to get rid of that sore throat. I guarantee you that this is an abuse of an antibiotic. I have individuals who, when they fill out their drug histories, give me three pages that are coded to show which combinations of drugs they were on in any given period. Often they were taking two or three prescribed drugs, Valium, Librium, erythromycin, plus designer drugs. You know, the gay community invented the designer drug. Amyl nitrate, nitrite, butyl nitrite, uppers, downers, and they would give me the whole, a whole coding. We're talking about a community where drugs are rampant. Stand. To which Harris Coulter replies, we don't have any idea of what their blood chemistry is anymore, and we don't know how much of the general population is in the same kind of chemical distortion. Let's go to another instance here. Start putting this together, right? Harris Coulter says, but the treatment of gonorrhea, syphilis, non-gonococcal urethritis, herpes, cytomegalovirus, and Epstein-Barr virus infections, chlamydia and candida, and the whole host of venereal diseases that have arisen in the wake of the sexual revolution of recent decades involves many additional immunosuppressant drugs. Skin rashes are among the most common symptoms of these diseases. Thus, quote, dermatological and other preparations, end quote, are the number one class of these prescribed for the class, quote, venereal disease, end quote, in the National Disease and Therapeutic Index. Of these preparations, tetracycline ointments, topocycline, acromycin ointment are very much at the forefront. The various corticosteroids are also dispensed wholesale by physicians, and since they are even advertised to the public on television, being available without a prescription, are consumed in large quantities without benefit of any sort of diagnoses. They are known to curtail the numbers of B and T lymphocytes in the circulating blood, besides depressing the immune response in several other ways. For the same condition, or perhaps for one of the dermatological consequences of gonorrhea or syphilis, the patient might be prescribed prednisone, which is so immunosuppressant that it is used to control the immune response and prevent rejection in organ transplant and skin graft operations. Chloramphenicol, or chloromycetin, the first synthetic antibiotic, was one of the most frequently prescribed drugs in the pharmacopoeia until it was found to be highly toxic to bone marrow formation. It caused death from, quote, blood dyscrasia, end quote, but despite this history, is today being prescribed for, quote, susceptible organisms which have been demonstrated to be resistant to all other appropriate antimicrobial agents, or, quote, superficial skin infections caused by bacteria susceptible to chloramphenicol, end quote. One chloromycetin preparation, Opfolchlor, is used in the treatment of herpes-related ophthalmia. Another compound, Opthocort, also used for ophthalmias, is contrived from cortisone and chloramphenicol and thus confers a dual immunosuppressive effect. The immunosuppression of drugs we're talking here, and of course, in the background histories of some of the AIDS patients, they found tremendous histories of sexually transmitted diseases. Okay? Now, let's go to page 46 here. Coulter says, but in tracking the genesis of AIDS, we are interested in the whole way of life of those who are particularly vulnerable. Joan McKenna and her co-workers in Berkeley, California, described as follows the medical histories of a group of 100 homosexual men interviewed by them. And I will tell you that up front, a fourth of this sample shared 9 or more of these conditions and patterns, and all individuals diagnosed as having AIDS or ARC were concentrated in this smaller group which shared the 9 or more of these conditions and patterns. And this is a list of patterns. Okay, among the most common presentations we have found are the following: gonorrhea, multiple incidents with treatment by antibiotic therapies, 20 incidents per year for 2 or more years was not uncommon. Hepatitis, high incidence of known hepatitis or positive antigen tests. 10% had chronic hepatitis of 5 years or longer duration. Non-specific urethritis, multiple presentations, sometimes chronic, in that an individual will report 6 or 7 episodes per year for up to 8 years. Higher doses and longer duration of antibiotics as condition became resistant to chemical intervention. Dermatological eruptions, specific palliative and prophylactic use of antibiotics, tetracycline and corticosteroids for skin eruptions. Reports of prescribed tetracycline for 5 to 8 years continuously. Sedatives, tranquilizers, and mood drugs for psychological conditions prescribed or used without prescription. Chronic sore throat. More than 50% report frequent episodes requiring antibiotic medications. herpes simplex, 25% report chronic herpes, 90% herpes within the past 10 years. Allergies, high incidence of history of chronic and severe allergies, allergy medications, and symptomatic suppressants. Lymphadenopathy, frequent to chronic swollen lymph glands in 40% of the sample for up to 25 years preceding survey. Diarrhea, high incidence of known and unknown etiologies, means causes. Frequent parasites suspected and parasitic treatments with and without confirmation of actual organisms in nearly 30% of our study. Recreational drugs, nearly universal use of marijuana, a multiple and complex use of LSD, MDA, PCP, heroin, cocaine, amyl and butyl nitrites, amphetamines, barbiturates, ethyl chloride, opium, mushrooms, and what are referred to as designer drugs. Okay? And then later down, the homosexual population in particular consumes these drugs regularly, often on a prophylactic basis, and thus suffers their full immunosuppressive effect. What is the reaction of the potential AIDS patient, for example, to one of that year's 20 incidents of gonorrhea? He will first seek an antimicrobial substance to rid himself of the gonococcus, and here one of the drugs of choice is tetracycline. In fact, tetracycline, as we will see, emerges as the preeminent prescribable for virtually every venereal disease, being used in the treatment not only of gonorrhea and syphilis, but also lymphadenitis, non-venereal urethritis, pelvic inflammatory disease, vaginitis, vulvitis, lymph node enlargement, and other venereal diseases as well. We're talking about the heaviest kind of immunosuppression from drugs. We're talking about pneumocystis carinii pneumonia resulting from an immune disorder, historically, always, and in the literature, one of the predisposing facts toward pneumocystis is antibiotic use. And whenever that was written, the person had no idea of the kind of prophylactic, preventative, continuous, long-term, incredible use of antibiotics that we're talking about here. The same with Kaposi sarcoma. Some Kaposi sarcoma has been found traceable to immunosuppressive drug. Was this followed up? Were these case histories shoved down the throats of NIH researchers at the highest levels? No. Did the scientists who could get no satisfaction from the people who kept screaming it's only the HIV virus go to the press? Did they risk anything? Not that I've seen. Nothing. Okay? Nothing. It's my opinion that any doctor who gives prophylactic prescriptions of antibiotics on a continuous and casual basis ought to be put in jail. There is much here to be thought about, Doctor. Much here to be looked at in the literature. What we know is there's a very high stakes role going on at the top. With the new CDC definition, with the new definition of AIDS in second generation in the third world, with almost, as ludicrous as it sounds, all human disease possibly being tied to the virus, can you imagine the feeling at the very top, the high-stakes role that the HIV virus could be, in a sense, the cause of almost all human disease? This is the kind of gamble that we're talking about at the top of the research ladder, and this is the kind of gamble that just obviously, commonsensically, is wrong. Impossible. Not going to work. Okay? So, a final note to physicians of Southern California and AIDS researchers. Another job has been passed to you, one more. Because what I've been describing is a case of social schizophrenia in which we make pronouncements on the need for testing while our researchers find it's fatally flawed. We recommend AZT while in the background we know it ruins what's left of immune systems. We hold out hope for a vaccine. Severe doubts that we'll get it or that we are even working with the right virus. We will engender the unprecedented dosing of the third world, weak, starving, undernourished, chronically malnourished people, these harmful drugs and vaccines, because a medical model is being made out of starvation in the third world, and the cure will be the drugs and the vaccines instead of food. And the drugs and the vaccines are killers in that situation. We know that in the third world, antibiotic use has sprung up tremendously in recent years. Over the counter, no prescription, swallow it, shoot it, whatever. It has been documented that we're now developing tremendous antibiotic resistance among people through plasmid transfers in the third world, in Africa specifically. This is happening. Is this being researched? Yet one more thing that has not been tied to pneumocystis carini, Kaposi sarcoma. Go back to the beginning. Go back to where the assumptions were made, the inferences were drawn. Look at this thing. It's your job to tell people about these frauds and deceptions. It's your job not to pass the buck, and it's your job not to collect it for any of this bad medicine, which violates the oath you once took. Thank you. Good night.
This is KPFK Los Angeles. We are listening to John Rappaport in a open letter to physicians. This was one of the AIDSgate programs, AIDSgate program number 6, as a matter of fact, and it was originally broadcast in 1987, and John Rappaport was a frequent part of that series, AIDSgate. There are some open phones, we're going to get to that, and there is some good news, and we're going to get to that too. John Rappaport wrote a book on AIDS called AIDS, Inc. AIDS, Inc. And it's not currently being published except as a computer printout or a computer feed or whatever the situation is. It is loaded and you can get it downloaded. AIDS, Inc. by John Rappaport, and for information on that, downloading his book, which has this and much, much, much more information, scrupulously researched, you can call Keith at the Phoenix Bookstore in Santa Monica. Ask for Keith, and Phoenix Bookstore, Santa Monica is... area code 213 or 310, I'm not sure which one, 395-9516, Santa Monica, area code 213 or 310, 395-9516, Phoenix Bookstore in Santa Monica, for downloading, for a tape, or actually tapes. It's an entire program with the open phones is over about 4.5 hours long. Part of the AIDSgate series, AIDSgate number 6, and for information on AIDSgate, you can send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Something's Happening, Box 8381, Universal City, California, 91608. Something's Happening, Box 8381, Universal City, 91608. Self-addressed stamped envelope. Ask for the AIDS Gate list. There are 12, I think, programs. And I'm going to add a 13th on the 17th of June. John Rappaport will be here live in studio for a 1992 update. Now that in the years since 1987, when this was recorded, the discoverer of the AIDS virus has come to publicly agree with John's position that HIV does not cause, of itself cause, AIDS. Dr. Montagnard has said that. He now agrees with John, so this was quite amazing work he did. And I apologize for the extra program in the background, but up to this point, the program was pre-recorded. John came in when I was doing, my Thursday night show, which was then probably Monday, and he sat in the studio and pre-recorded this, and I guess the door was not, or the two doors weren't closed or something. It was lousy engineering, which was my fault, I'm afraid. But looking at on the broadcast, you're getting about 1.5 nights of programming on one night. So that's pretty fantastic. We will get to the one of the cures for all of this madness in about 20 minutes. In the meantime, shortly after this open letter to physicians was recorded, we broadcast it live on the air. John Rappaport then came in live in the studio at the time, and we took open phone calls from people who had just heard what you've just heard. And we'll be back at 5 with True Health, KPFK Los Angeles. This is KPFK Los Angeles. We've just heard a pre-recorded presentation, an open letter to physicians by journalist John Rappaport. Sorry for the crosstalk. I left the door open to the studio, but consider that you're getting an extra Monday night program thrown in for no extra charge. John Rappaport is here now live and available on open phones for a comment. We'll open up the phones after a few remarks, closing remarks from John Rappaport. Okay, John. What do you say?
Well, one of the things I didn't get a chance to spell out completely on the previous tape was, one of the things I would like to see is a complete overview done on cases of AIDS vis-a-vis their medical backgrounds, their medical histories, their drug histories, to cross lines that have been previously set up, these risk group lines. In other words, we've been sort of brainwashed into thinking that we've got the IV drug users over here, we've got the heterosexuals over here, we've got the gay men over here, we've got the Hispanic cases over here, and we've got the Brazilians and the Africans. But just suppose for a minute that we find that the background profiles of all of these people are similar, or at least a great number of them. It wouldn't have to be all of them. In their medical histories or their lack of nutrition or their malnourishment, in very obvious ways, like the incredible prophylactic use of antibiotics, these people all have tremendous and severe immune depression to start with.
Now, prophylactic use of antibiotics refers to
preventative use up front. In other words, someone suspects that they might have a sexual encounter, or they might get a sore throat, or they might have some problem with the health, so they have a script in their hands and they can fill it. and they can fill it for tetracycline, say, for example. And they can keep doing that over a very long period of time. So suppose that in all of these cases, or a lot of them, we find that initially there existed enough immune suppression to account for the, quote, opportunistic infections, which are called now AIDS. If that were the case, then many severe questions would be raised about the direction of the viral research, because in essence you would be saying, hey, these people at the outset had enough immune suppression to bring about these infections, which are now called AIDS, the pneumocystis carinii, the Kaposi sarcoma, the oral thrush, all of this kind of stuff, the fungal infections. And the second thing I would like to see, which is much more outlandish and difficult to obtain, is simply a recognition on the part of doctors that we have gone too far in immunosuppressive drug therapy. We have used too many drugs that suppress the immune system. We have overloaded the health of patients, and that it's now time to call a moratorium on the use worldwide of clearly immunosuppressive drugs, period, for a period of reevaluation of the effects of these drugs on worldwide populations in terms of inducing disease.
But you're going against the grain. Instead of helping to market a new killer drug that everybody could take, whether or not one has AIDS, you are advocating a slowdown of the drugs that we're already taking, which suppress the legal drugstore type of drugs that suppress the immune system. And that's not profitable at all.
I'm sorry. That's right. There's the legal suppression of the immune system and the illegal suppression of the immune system. That's true. So, yeah, I guess I'm a little bit against the grain here, just a hair, Tad.
Want to take some phone calls?
Yeah, let's go.
My brave listeners that have stayed up through all this. Hello?
Hello? You're on? I'd like to know, of the people who have AIDS, you said there were 2 million people infected with the AIDS virus, but there are people who had AIDS. Maybe I didn't understand, but how do we know that they have AIDS if you're telling me that they could have... it sounds to me, I didn't comprehend all the diseases you said, but it sounds to me like they could have hundreds of viruses, hundreds of bacteria, and be called AIDS.
Correct. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that there is a shell game going on now, which is the proliferation of the definition of AIDS, second-generation definition, and now it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to gauge through this smokescreen of statistics what is actually happening to the health of people. But I'm not trying to say that nothing has, that people's health hasn't been damaged, that people aren't dying, just the reverse. Some very obvious, clear things happened at the beginning of all of this. We had people with Kaposi sarcoma, pneumocystis carinii, oral candidiasis, these kinds of infections that were rare, and suddenly they were proliferating. This was the thing that doctors noticed, and they said, hey, what's going on here? 4 years later, they said, it's this little thing called the HIV virus that's causing the immune suppression. And now, 3 years later, the CDC is saying you don't have to have a diagnosis of HIV to even have AIDS. It's a mess, and you're right. And what doctors have to do is go back to the original observations of the original doctors who saw that something was the matter, some change in the health pattern of Africa, in certain places, in the United States, in certain places, and to rethink that and see what's going on. And what I'm suggesting is that they start looking at the backgrounds of those patients and their medical histories very seriously to see if that wasn't enough immune suppression right there at the start to account for all of these opportunistic infections.
So basically the whole issue is politics and which doctors are going to say we're right, and the other doctors say we're right, and who gets the grant money, etc.
afraid so. At least that's the way it looks to me.
Yeah. Quickly, I heard it was maybe a year ago. What is HTLV-3 compared to HIV?
Same thing, just different names.
Okay, exactly the same?
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, my understanding is that HTLV-3 had to be retracted and that there was an error of some sort made and a correction to create HIV.
Yes.
I haven't really heard.
There was a lot of scandal and gossip around that. Gallo named it HTLV-3. He had already discovered two viruses called HTLV-1 and 2, and this was going to be kind of like, you know, the crown, the peak of the crown of his three viruses. And then people started pointing out that this AIDS virus, HTLV-3, was actually more similar to other kinds of viruses, not his two earlier viruses, and that therefore it was misleading and the name ought to be changed. That was one of the things that happened. And so everybody said, okay, let's call it HIV and not argue about it.
Now, the tape I gave you, that woman doctor.
Dr. Sneed, yeah.
Dr. Sneed, she mentions that Gallo discovered or began his research on the virus on the day that another physician won a Nobel Prize for discovering another virus. That this is her accusation, is that Gallo's after a Nobel Prize and he's going to get it by hook or crook, evidently by crook.
Some people think so. Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about that, that maybe he used photos that the French took of their virus, their AIDS virus, which they were calling LAV, and that he maybe, you know, used some of their photos to identify so-called his virus, you know. It was a mess. They finally supposedly have settled this all now, and everybody's lovey-dovey and cooperating. But who knows?
Hello?
Oh, in order to fully understand everything that was said tonight, I'll have to go over the tape I just made, also to fully understand everything that Jack Garris was saying. But the one question I have had on my mind for a little while now was, you say that the way we define AIDS in Africa is almost indistinguishable from the symptoms for malnutrition?
Right.
Well, has anybody ever taken a test where they would take a representative sampling? I realize they don't test for HIV in every single AIDS patient in Africa. But has anybody ever tested for HIV in a representative sampling of putative AIDS victims in Africa to see if large numbers of them do in fact have the HIV virus?
Yes, and they have found that in certain groups, like they'll take a group of prostitutes that a very high percentage do test positive for the HIV virus. That's right. But what you have to understand is that when you introduce a new definition or you change the old definition to now include symptoms that very clearly can stem from chronic malnutrition and starvation, you're now doing this, as I mentioned, because you want a clinical eyeball diagnosis away from clinical labs that can test, because you know that in most places in Africa you don't have labs available to you. What this is going to do, my prediction, is you will see now huge numbers of diagnoses of AIDS by doctors who have no lab facilities, and what they'll really be diagnosing at the root, is malnutrition and starvation.
Wouldn't the counter-argument to that be, though, in previous cases where we have diagnosed AIDS, people with these symptoms, which could be considered symptoms of malnutrition, that in fact, you know, a majority of them did have the HIV virus, and therefore we can assume that, you know, anytime you do, make such a diagnosis, you are going to get, most of the time you're going to get somebody with the HIV virus.
No, I think that's too big an inference to draw, because the samples are too isolated and too small, and in fact, there are other problems with assuming, for example, that the HIV virus was causative to begin with and not just a symptom, not just a passenger. That issue is not resolved simply by finding HIV in people, because you can find, say, CMV in those people too a lot of the time, which is cytomegalovirus, but nobody's saying that that's the cause of AIDS. So that's a separate issue, the causative factor about HIV. No, I think that the sample is too small, too disparate, and you can't really infer that, therefore, everybody who's got these symptoms is going to have the HIV virus and that that's the cause of AIDS.
What brought on the new definition of AIDS? Is it simply because we can't get the health facilities to putative victims in Africa? And does that mean that this extremely broad and wide-ranging new definition of AIDS will not apply, you know, one would assume, to people in America for whom you would have to test for the HIV virus?
Yeah, except now you don't have to test for the HIV virus even in America. If you heard that part about the new CDC definition, there are two out of three ways of defining AIDS in the U.S. as of September 4th, where you don't even need an HIV test there. And that's the rules of the CDC. But yes, this is one of the strange things about AIDS. You get this business where, you know, in one country AIDS is defined one way, in another country it's defined another way. And this would all be well and good if you actually knew exactly what you were dealing with here. But I'm afraid that we're getting to the point now where maybe if you're, you know, if you break your foot, maybe you won't get diagnosed as having AIDS. But just about everything else, you're up for the possibility of having that diagnosis slapped on you.
With Roy's permission, I would like to ask one more question.
Sure.
Regarding the article in the Covert Action Information Bulletin, I'm afraid somebody hustled my copy, so it's been a while since I looked at it. But there was a very long article that nobody seems to refer to very much, which I thought was very good, about the possibility of HIV requiring cofactors. It seems to be a very theoretical beginning attempt to correlate Strecker's thesis with Duisberg's thesis. I wondered if you can recall the article to which I'm referring, and I know that you referred in your speech a little bit to this, but if you could comment on it and what you think of the possibilities.
Well, I think there are definite possibilities that we could be talking about several scenarios operating in concert, okay? And one of them could be that, for example, let's say a virulent form of simian virus, which has been goofed around with and jazzed up and altered both intentionally and by accident in monkey research centers around the world, has gotten into the human population. Let's suppose that. That's quite possible, practically speaking. And let's suppose that you combine that kind of situation with one in which there are many people throughout the world, for various reasons, who are already immune-depressed. These are now the cofactors. And now you can be talking cofactors like toxic chemicals in the environment, someone's working around radioactivity, like it's rumored that people do in Zaire. I mean, they mine cobalt in Zaire. You have people in other countries taking huge amounts of antibiotics and destroying their immune systems. So all of these things would be your, quote, cofactors. And now let's suppose you have this combination of a very weird, altered and jazzed up monkey virus that skipped species into the human population through lab workers, and it gets out into the general population and starts to infect people who are very immune depressed already. That's quite possible.
Well, the combination would be necessary, I would think, because those cofactors to which you refer, they apply to 101 places where there are no AIDS. You were talking about malnutrition in Brazil, but there's malnutrition throughout Latin America. So why is AIDS concentrating in Brazil? Why is AIDS not in India or Pakistan or Bangladesh?
Very good question. It's been said, I can't vouch for this, but it wouldn't surprise me, that some spokesman in India, it's very generalized, has said that they're not even going to start reporting cases until they get up to 1 million, because they've got so many other health problems they can't deal with this. So I think that underreporting could be an issue in many places where you say, well, they don't have AIDS there and they have malnutrition. Well, maybe they do have some form of AIDS there. So that's hard to say. That's a difficult one to pin. But Brazil I could talk about for quite some time, because they have a bunch of different health problems there that are being masked by this idea of AIDS being rampant in Brazil. They have lots of other health difficulties. And I'll just give you one example. In the literature, for example, there is reference to the fact that if you have malaria, you will test positive for the AIDS virus just because you have malaria.
Wow.
Now, if that's true, you see, in Brazil, we have tremendous upsurge in malaria. So suppose all this positive HIV testing is false positives based on malaria, or let's say a large percentage of it. Now you have just this complete mishmash. In addition to all the stuff I was talking about AIDS and being reliable, now you have another factor thrown in. So I think we have to return to some basics here. One of the basics is, what are the backgrounds of the people that we are saying have AIDS? And I'd be willing to bet the farm here that the overwhelming majority of people that have contracted so-called AIDS in the world are not formerly healthy people.
Okay, well, that's all we have time for tonight from the AIDSgate number 6 program, Open Letter to Physicians. We had some exciting surprises early in the program, and it kind of threw us off, but in a very positive direction, that we got some insight into the government's, the FDA's attempt to separate us from nutritional medicines or nutritional substances. And then we got into the AIDSgate, of which this is AIDSgate number 6. It goes on for another hour and a half of the open phones. It was an all-nighter back in 1987, when this new information, which is still new, although more agreed upon by higher and higher scientific spokespeople, including the discoverer of the so-called AIDS virus, Dr. Montagnier in France. John Rappaport wrote a book called AIDS, Inc., and it's available only now through a computer download situation. And you can find out how to download AIDS, Inc., John Rappaport's book on your computer. Call Keith at Phoenix Bookstore, area 213-395-9516. Keith at the Phoenix Bookstore in Santa Monica, 213-395-9516. The book, John Rappaport, AIDS, Inc. The AIDS book will probably do. The book is expected to be possibly republished this summer because it's finally reality's catching up with the book. John Rappaport will be here live giving us an update in June, live in studio. And I've announced June 17th, which is not true. That's when he'll be speaking at the Phoenix Bookstore. But he'll be here Monday night, Tuesday morning, June 15th, the first Monday after the 5 upcoming, which you're going to contribute to, I'm sure. June 15th, John Rappaport will be here live in studio, 1992 update. Or maybe he'll push things up into 1998. In the meantime, as promised, and we will get to the rest of AIDSgate number 6, by the way, an open letter to physicians. If you're interested in the AIDSgate programs, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll send you a piece of paper listing the couple pieces, listing the, I think, 13 AIDSgate programs from the Monumental series, which was off the wall in 86 and 87, but reality's catching up to it in 92. AIDSgate. Everything You Know Is Wrong, and send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Something's Happening, P.O. Box 8381, in Universal City, California, 91608. S-A-S-E to Something's Happening, Box 8381, Universal City, California, 91608. This is just for the AIDSgate address. The other kind of business you want to send, please send it to the regular station.